weather with Liberty Insurance. Ready to get a quote on your car insurance? Find out more at libertyinsurance.ie.
Hazy sunshine in most places this evening. Tonight will be mostly dry with lowest temperatures of 9 degrees.
Game on 2FM. With Green Firm, a nourishing addition to any sandwich, salad, stir fry or snack. Natural protein your way.
Thanks, Jan. It's Wednesday, the 30th of June. This is Game On. I'm John Kenny. For the next hour coming up today, we'll hear from the cream of Irish golf as the Dubai duty-free Irish Open returns to Mount Juliet.
Yeah, feeling good. It's nice to be back. A bit of a shame that I couldn't bring the family with me, but I mean, it's, you know, FaceTime and everything else makes it a bit easier. It's going to be a great 3 weeks of golf. I'm looking forward to playing here, hopefully getting off to a good start in this run that I've got coming up, go to the Scottish, go to the Open. But first and foremost, I want to play well here this week and get my game in shape.
4-1 favourite, Rory McIlroy, will hear from him, also Padraig Harrington and Shane Lowry as well. Live to Merseyside for the latest as Rafa Benitez is confirmed as the new Everton manager.
What you are expecting from your manager is you fight for your club, and I will do that. So seems I'm here, I will fight for my club, I will try to win every single game, and it doesn't matter the opponents or the rivals. So it's something that you have to do, it's in your natural that you have to try to do your best. And why a lot of fans in a lot of these cities, they love me, is because I was giving everything for them.
Mm-hmm. Controversial. Plus in ladies football, former Dublin great Denise Masterson on the Dubs' latest trophy win.
Play that again!
The sound.
Well, come on in. Text number 51552. That's 51552. You can tweet at GameOn2FM. And Alan Cawley, I'm glad to say, is joining me in studio as well. Going to talk a bit of footy a little bit later on. But you're a golf man as well, aren't you? Looking forward to the Irish Open?
I am, John. First of all, it's good to see you. How are you?
Oh, good, yeah. Good form.
Good
playing
stuff.
A bit of football myself this morning, actually.
You never stop, do you?
Never stop.
Football, golf.
Carry me home in my shield rather than me carrying it home.
Brilliant. Well, that's the way. Fair play to you. So I hope I'm doing the same when I'm your age, John.
About 2 or 3 years' time. Yeah, sure. Anyway, who's your favourite? Well, obviously, McIlroy is 4-1 favourite, but there's a good Irish contingent there. We know Lowry, Harrington. Lowry's the first one to tee off, actually, from the Irish contingent on the 10th tee at 8 o'clock tomorrow. He's got Jonathan Caldwell and Martin Kaymer. That's a good three ball.
Yeah, funny, I watched a bit of the golf last week, the European event in Munich, and Martin Kaymer seemed to be playing well, so it's funny you mention him, actually, that he's playing with Shane. He could have a good week, but it is good to see the Irish contingent, especially the big names. That's what you want for this tournament, John, and hopefully the weather obviously was amazing today. If we could get that for 3 or 4 days, it should be a great event.
Sure, and Euros continuing, and
the
quarterfinals.
Absolutely loving the Euros, to be fair. Obviously the game yesterday wasn't great, but from the drama
which one?
Side.
Which one?
The England one.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
In terms of a game itself.
Because I thought Sweden-Ukraine was actually a decent game last
year. Yeah,
time.
Well, I enjoyed the England-Germany game because of the whole kind of, it was fascinating in terms of the tactical side of it. There was a lot of tension involved because of what was at stake. But the night before, the two games that we had with Spain, obviously, and the French game, absolutely incredible. And I was delighted for Switzerland as well. I know later on we're probably going to talk all about the England stuff. But just going back to Monday night's games, I thought the France-Switzerland game was absolutely epic. Mm. Really was. And that's why, like, obviously, we've spoken a lot about the fans being back in the grounds. But the major tournaments, I think people have been a bit critical and a bit harsh on international football in recent times. There's nothing like a major tournament, John. It's incredible.
Absolutely. Especially the Euros. I think the Euros is probably, I mean, it might even edge the World Cup.
I would always go for the Euros over the World Cup. That opinion would have always been based on the fact when it was 16 teams and the cream of the crop. But the fact that they've obviously expanded out to the 24, I don't think that's taken away from this year's competition either. I think it's been brilliant.
Yeah, imagine to think back in 1988, there was only 8.
Incredible,
It was the cream of the crop.
And like, we have to be realistic in terms of us wanting to go to a major tournament. We need the tournaments to be expanded.
Sure.
You know,
yeah,
like,
because we won't get there otherwise.
No, let's be honest about that, but the Euros for me with the 16, and now we will have that. I know there's been a couple of surprises and people might not have predicted the 8 that we've left, but I always think with the best 16 teams that it always makes for a great tournament, and the Euros over the years has been absolutely brilliant, but this one is delivering. I don't know if it's because of the last year and a half, was what we've gone through and stuff, and we needed something like this, but the games have been absolutely brilliant.
Sure. If you wonder where Marie is, by the way, she will be presenting the golf down in Mount Juliet for RT Television. So congratulations to her. Hope it goes well for her for the 4 days that she's there. Another one who, of course, will be there for the 4 days for us will be Greg Annan. Greg, how was the Pro-Am today?
Ah, the Pro-Am in the sunshine. I just hope they get
Des Smith
better.
Was your pro, I believe.
Yes, I played in the Pro-Am this morning. It's a rare thing. We were out crack of dawn, and it really is a fantastic privilege, obviously, to play in a Pro-Am because you're playing the golf course as it's been set up for the week. So, you know, I don't necessarily think it's going to inform my reports in any sort of intelligent way, but it's...
Well, it gets you to walk around the course and find the lays and things like that as well when you're doing some commentary yourself. You know it yourself. How'd you play?
We're going to not talk about that. We're going to talk about how wonderful company it is to play with Des Smith, who I've had the privilege of playing it with, you know, quite a lot. In fact, we played in the Pro-Am, and I reminded him of this just before we teed off at 7:30 this morning, back in 1993, when the first Irish Open in Mount Juliet was played here. And I also played early morning with him back then, and it just was a fantastic sort of rush back of memories to tee off in the 10th tee as we did back in 1993, 28 years ago. Goodness knows where did the years go. Anyway,
how's Des swinging them, all right?
So he's still swinging it so smoothly. It's just, he's just a beautiful player to play alongside, just to watch the rhythm that he has that has changed very little over the years. And Des, he's basically retired now. He's had such a successful career in seniors golf in America on the Champions Tour. Of course, he's an 8-time European Tour winner, twice a winner on the Champions Tour. And now he's retired and plays social golf, as he says. But he played nicely this morning. We didn't do anything as a team because we didn't back him up. But look, a bit less about what we did in the Pro-Am.
Well, I'm just a little bit jealous, I must say. I've done it before. I've actually played in a couple of Pro-Ams. I played Carton House, and I think I played Mount Juliet as well. Well, now when I say I played, I walked around with a stick in my hand. It just was slightly different.
If you think you played at Mount Juliet, John, you did, because you'd never forget playing here.
It's absolutely. Oh, no, it's a fabulous place. I have been lucky enough to play there as well. Anyway, look, at, as you say, enough about you, enough about me. Dubai Duty Free Irish Open Eve. We have a whole host of Irish players, and obviously a lot of them in contention. Open champion Lowry, we got Rory Carrington there, former champion Rory McIlroy, the 4-1 favourite as well at Al. How's it shaping up?
It's shaping up quite well. I think the depth of the field is hugely bolstered by the fact that we've got the Irish stars here. Without the Irish stars, you know, I don't think it would be a deep enough field to warrant a €3 million Euro European Tour event, to be brutally honest, because, you know, Tommy Fleetwood, 33rd in the world, and Christian Bezuidenhout, who's number 47 in the world, are, you know, the two other top 50 players who are playing alongside McIlroy and Lowry, which means, like, it's a good field. It's just not as in-depth a field as you're going to have next week at the Scottish Open, and obviously it's not going to, you know, compete with the Open Championship in 2 weeks' time. But by comparison to the Scottish Open next week, Rory McIlroy's presence here is utterly massive, as is Shane Lowry, because they bring star sprinkles all over the place. And this venue, in the sunshine today and yesterday in the practice round, there is something about Mount Juliet. It's just a big time venue, because the American Express Championship, the World Golf Championship event, won by Tiger Woods in 2002, won by Ernie Els in 2004, added to the three Irish Opens that were held here back in the 1990s, won by Nick Faldo, Bernhard Langer, Sam Torrance. There's always a big time winner at Mount Juliet, and it's a big feeling big time venue, and it just feels like a really good week is in prospect here, and hopefully we'll have a big time winner, and hopefully it's either Shane or Rory, or maybe Padraig Harrington, who's back in real form again, fourth in the PGA Championship just a few weeks ago. And, you know, I think first and foremost, I'd like to talk about Shane, because I spoke to him today. I spoke to Rory yesterday. We'll hear from him in a moment. But Shane Lowry obviously comes here, you know, on the back of some pretty good form, because obviously he was fourth in the PGA Championship at Kiawah Island. He was sixth the following week in the PGA Tour. He didn't have such a, you know, a good week on the tour in the US Open, because he shot a final round of 79. But he actually was going much better than that US Open finish suggested, because on Saturday in the third round he came to the 16th hole with a real chance of perhaps being a top 10, top 15 finisher, and he missed a putt of no more than 2 feet, and all the air went out of his challenge after that. Anyway, I spoke to him today about what he's looking forward to and what he thinks about Mount Juliet.
Who knows, every course is a Shane Lowry course. If I drive it well, him irons well and hold a few putts, so it's, you know, typically I haven't done great in Irish Opens over the years, so, you know, this year I probably have a decent bit of form coming in here, so hopefully I can go out there and be myself and let myself play the best golf I can, I suppose.
There was that one Irish Open that you played pretty well in.
I didn't know what it was about back then. You know, I just rocked up thinking this is just another tournament, and I, you know, went home with a trophy on the Sunday. So I'm obviously hopeful I can have a good week. I feel like my game's in good shape. I felt great going into Torrey Pines. I didn't perform as well as I would have liked, but leading up to that, we all have bad weeks, and I'm chalking that down to just an average or a bad week, and, you know, move on from that.
Just tell me about US Open Torrey Pines, because that's the last tournament you've played before here, so we're looking at your form line, and before that you were 6th and 4th in your previous two tournaments. Obviously there's a big form line there. Did you just run out of steam a little bit in the US Open?
Look, playing US Opens is always very difficult. There were certain times where, you know, I go back to Saturday evening at the US Open, and that's where, you know, my tournament ended in 3 holes, really. I was 3 over for the tournament, playing 16, missed a short putt and bogeyed the last. You know, play those holes a little bit differently, and I would have been going into Sunday with a bit of a pep in my step, and then all of a sudden I was going into Sunday a bit deflated, needing to shoot 500 to have a good week, and you'd go out and try and force it around somewhere like Torrey Pines and you just have no chance. So it's you know, golf's a, you know, it's a funny game sometimes, and you know, even though you look like you're further away than you probably are, you know, sometimes you're further away than you look. So it's just I just put it down to, you know, a bad week. But I think, you know, the whole week kind of, you know, I don't know what way went bad on the 16th on the Saturday evening. So, you know, ifs and buts, but yeah, just that's golf, that's the way it goes.
You're here and you do have the claret jug in the room, and it's only 2 more weeks in your hands. Mm. The Irish Open is very important, but in the run into the Open, how are you feeling?
Yeah, good. I've not defended a major before or something like the Open. It's going to be a big deal. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be an amazing week, an exciting week, but it's obviously going to be something that I've not experienced. So no matter what happens, I'll learn from it and move on. Hopefully I can go there and give myself a chance to win again, but, you know, who knows what'll happen.
8 o'clock start tomorrow morning, the 10th tee for Shane Lowry, Jonathan Caldwell and Martin Kaymer. 8:10, Padraig Harrington, along with Thomas Dietrich of Belgium and Andy Sullivan of England, Greg.
Yeah, and Thomas Dietrich is a World Cup winner, and Andy Sullivan is a Ryder Cup player, so it's a good 3-ball. Harrington, of course, comes in with real form, and this is not something that you expect from a Ryder Cup captain who's preoccupied with what's going to be happening in September. But he has shown it. This time 9 months ago when he played in the Irish Open, he was in the 400s, around 450 in the world. He's moved up around 300 places over the last 9 months, and emphasised by that fourth place finish in the PGA Championship at Kiwa Island, where, you know, he almost had a squeak of being in contention. He only ended up 4 shots off the winning total of Phil Mickelson. There's Phil Mickelson at 50 years of age, winning, and Padraig Harrington at 49 years of age, finishing tied for fourth place. And Harrington, I really think he feels he's got a great chance this week. And he spoke to me just earlier this afternoon.
I'm quite relaxed, happy about the way things are going. You know, there's no doubt at the moment, like the Open is 2 weeks' time, 3 weeks, 3 tournaments, and you've got definitely thinking about that, trying to get ready for that and trying to do the right things now so that I'm ready in 2 weeks' time, which actually could work out very nicely for the Irish Open. I'm being quite disciplined this week. I'm seeing some very nice signs. I'm just trying to not put myself under too much pressure, too much stress, and let it all come out.
So how do you balance the fact that you know that you're a real contender? You were 4th in the PGA Championship, you were 4 shots off the winning total, and you know that the winner was older than you. It's all doable again. Is this sort of a feeling that's both physical and mental, that you can re-energise this part of your career and be a winner again, and Irish Open, even the Open in 2 weeks' time?
Yeah, look, it's got to be a positive that Phil, at his age, has won a major tournament, and you know, when you're somebody a contemporary peer, or those things like that, it makes it definitely more real for you to go and believe that you can do it. If he hadn't won, though, I'm the sort of personality that I can think you can do things that others don't. So I'm a dreamer, and I dreamt that I could do it. Yes, it makes it more real, but physically I'm well capable of playing the game, and I like where I'm at now with my golf swing, so I'm very much focused on that mental side, and want to get myself into contention, put myself under a bit of heat, and see what it's like under pressure, and I know do that a few times, and you know, it would start feeling good.
So do you feel the same things running through your playing golf veins as you did in, say, 2007, 2008, because of this fact that you know that you can win again, and you really can win again, because you were a major contender just a few weeks ago?
No, let's be blunt about it. In 2007, you know, 2008, I knew I was going to win. Now I hope I can win, and it's a very, you know, it's very easy to see when a player is in that form. He turns up and he's not looking over his shoulder. He realizes that he's the winner if he does his stuff. Whereas you're in a boat where I am now, I'm kind of like, oh, you know what, if things go right for me, I can win. Whereas I didn't feel like that in 2007. I just knew things. I knew I was going to have a chance of winning, and that was it. And I do see some good signs where I'm starting to feel comfortable with my game. That, you know, I don't need to have anything special. I just need to have my own game this week, and that's what I'm aiming for. Just do my stuff and see where it's at.
Where does the Irish Open stand in your year, as in terms of your scale of importance?
There's one big one that I don't even get to hit a shot in, that's the most important. Then we follow it up with the four majors, and then the Irish Open, as always. So for this year, normally it's the fifth biggest tournament of the year. For this year, it's the sixth. Look, I'd love to get out there and get myself in contention, give a bit of a buzz to the spectators that are here. And it is nice. If we get the weather, it's just going to be, yeah, I know it's a limited number of spectators, but it's going to be exciting, it's going to be fun. I think Mount Juliet really lends itself to a nice golfing venue.
Yeah, 2,500 allowed after Harrington at 9:20 from the Irish point of view. Cormac Sharvin, Paul Dunn and Gregory Havray. Niall Carney, who played so well last weekend, is out with the two South Africans at 12:50. And then Greg, Rory McIlroy takes to the course alongside John Catlin and Tommy Fleetwood at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, and Rory McIlroy is obviously the favourite here for very good reason. He's playing kind of well again, and I know that people will look at the way that he, you know, in the US Open on the 11th hole, having played really solidly for the first 10 holes, held a share of the lead, right in contention, just two off the lead when he came to the 11th in Torrey Pines, and then having speared a beautiful 5-iron into the heart of the green with the pin tucked where it was, there wasn't any point going at it with a 5-iron, he couldn't have really hit a better tee shot. And then almost out of nowhere, the air just completely went out of his challenge with a 3-putt, and it was a bad 3-putt as well. The first putt was fairly weak, you know, left it to the right of the hole, good 4.5 feet beneath the hole, and a fairly straightforward putt. He just didn't hit it properly. He just didn't hit it well. And it was one of those things that happens, and unfortunately happens to McIlroy possibly too often in terms of his major championship challenges over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, going back to when he won the two majors that he did in 2014, the Open and the PGA Championship. And he knows this. But what he got out of the US Open was a huge amount of feeling of being in contention again. And if you scale all the way back to 2014, the only major in which he's really had a chance of winning on the final day was the Open at Carnoustie in 2018, when he was actually tied for the lead on the back nine at one stage. So look, McIlroy got more out of this US Open than he's got out of all of those, you know, running into the top five sort of finishes from not being in contention that he's had in majors over the last few years. And there have been many of those. And with the changes that he's made over the last 4 or 5 months through the Pete Cowan phase now that he's going through, his coach is Pete Cowan. Michael Bannon is definitely in the background, but is not his primary coach in terms of what he's doing right now. And with each experience McIlroy's getting, he seems to be getting freer, more happier to put what's on the practice ground into play with a card in his hand. And this is the critical element of all. Doesn't matter how you play in practice, it's how you play with a card in your hand, especially in majors. This Irish Open, I think, is very important to him in a way, because this course really sets up well for him. It's a typical sort of PGA Tour golf course in Ireland. It's a Jack Nicklaus signature course. And I think he's got a great, great chance this week because he's got form. And he also has come into this quite relaxed. I spoke to him yesterday. He's just sad that he couldn't bring the family with him because of all the COVID restrictions that there are coming to this side of the world, having been in America for the last year and a half.
Yeah, feeling good. It's nice to be back. A bit of a shame that I couldn't bring the family with me, but I mean, it's, you know, FaceTime and everything else makes it a bit easier. But it's going to be a great 3 weeks of golf. I'm looking forward to playing here. Hopefully getting off to a good start in this run that I've got coming up, go to the Scottish, go to the Open. But first and foremost, I want to play well here this week and get my game in shape. And, you know, I was really encouraged by with the way I played at the US Open. So hopefully I can just, you know, have a continuation of that and give myself another chance to win.
You know, the US Open, you stepped off the course tied for seventh, and you finished much higher than seventh in lots of majors, but for the last five, six, 7 years.
but you were so encouraged because you felt that you were really in contention and you got something out of it. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think it was that, plus I felt in control of my game on Sunday, and there's been some times where I haven't felt completely in control of what I've been doing out there, especially when it's a pretty high-pressure situation like the final round of a major. So that was very encouraging, you know, hitting some of the shots that I hit and just the overall feeling that I had out there. You know, I came off the course obviously disappointed with the way I finished, but very encouraged by just sort of how I felt out there. So, yeah, I didn't, you know, I tried to spend as much time as possible with the family last week before coming here, so I didn't practice that much, but, you know, I don't think it's going to leave me in a week. And, you know, I hit a few balls and played nine holes today, and it feels pretty good.
You're about 4 months or more into the Pete Cowan changes. You know Pete from back when you were a boy, you know, so you do know that it's a very familiar type of person doing something somewhat different. How much closer are you to being so free with your swing that you can play with that freedom that we've seen from you before?
Yeah, it's very close. Again, I think that's just all those, what I'm talking about with those feelings at the US Open, just, you know, very encouraged of sort of just how everything felt. But it's, I said to someone last week, it's the first time in a while where I've had, you know, the same consistent two or three swing thoughts for like a while. You know, it's sort of, I felt for the last year or so, it's sort of been try something for a few weeks, go away from it, try something elsewhere. It's nice to have some consistency in the thought process that you're going through, which makes practice much easier because, you know, you go there, you do your drills, you do what you're supposed to do, and you feel like you've had a good session, and you're not, you know, there's a way to quantify that you've actually improved or you've done what you've wanted to do. So yeah, it's been good. And yeah, at the start it took a while. Even at Quail Hollow, probably didn't feel quite, you know, as good as it does now, but just every week it's just started to feel a little more comfortable.
Rory McIlroy there, one of the shortest price favourites, Greg, for the Irish Open in quite a while. And he's playing with, as I mentioned, Tommy Fleetwood and John Catlin. I know you were talking to Fleetwood as well today about his Irish lineage.
Yeah, and Tommy is very popular right throughout the world, but I think he's especially popular on the island of Ireland after, you know, he was the man who...
He's carrying my money, by the way, so...
Okay, well, he's got a reasonable chance.
I think he's got a good chance, yeah, each way, yeah.
But, you know, Tommy, after the 2019 Open Championship in Royal Portrush, he was a player who played alongside Shane Lowry in the final round. It could easily have gone Tommy's way if the first hole had been different, because Tommy had a great chance to birdie it. He didn't, from 8 feet. If Lowry had, you know, missed the 7-footer, he would have double bogeyed it. It would have been a huge swing change. There would have been only one shot between them heading to the second tee. But as it turned out, Lowry did what he had to do and went on to win by 6. And Tommy's good grace in the 18th green, just he's just one of the good guys on tour. Anyway, we can also have another reason to like him, because he's a quarter Irish, as he told me this afternoon.
I am a quarter Irish. My mum's maiden name is Riley. So, yeah, I have Irish heritage in me somewhere.
So it's a grandparent?
Grandparent, yeah. Jeffrey.
So you'd be somebody, if one of our Irish players doesn't win on Sunday, we'd be quite happy to celebrate as an Irish win almost.
Well, I'm clearly the next best thing, yeah, so let's go for that one. I would have thought you'd have wanted me above the Irish players, but just below is fine as well.
Last time you were on the island of Ireland, was it that final round in Portrush?
Could be, actually, yeah. Thank you for reminding me.
No, and the reason I'm reminding you is because it's one of the greatest events in the history of Ireland.
I thought it was terrible.
Irish and Irish golf, and you felt it was terrible. and you contributed to what was an extraordinary final day. I mean, clearly, if you won an Irish Open, there'd be sort of a nice symmetry to it, wouldn't there?
Well, yeah, it would. I would like to swap them if I do have an Irish Open, but that's fine too. I'll take the Irish Open and run with it. Portrush was amazing. You know, if I never hit a golf shot again, Portrush would go down in my life as the closest I ever got to like my ultimate dream. So it's special for those reasons. And it was. It was an amazing sporting occasion, and it couldn't have gone any better for you guys and for the nation. So I was, you know, it was great being a part of that.
Yeah, huge pressure with my money on his back. Greg, Alan, I'll ask you this before we wrap things up. Greg, who is your money on? Who do you think? Rory?
Look, I think Rory has a great chance. As Shane Lowry said, every course is a Shane Lowry course if he can get the ball in the hole with the putter and hits a good drive and good irons, but especially if he can get the ball in the hole with the putter. One of the things that Shane has done so well this year is tee to green. His statistics are terrific. We know he's got, you know, magic in his hands with a wedge in his hands around the greens. He's just got a beautiful short game. So I think Rory, with the way he's playing and the fact that it's really not that deep a field in terms of the stars of the game, but I will say Rory is my probably favourite, but watch out for Christian Bezuidenhout, the South African, ranks number 47 in the world. He's in a lot of form at the moment, and I think he's got a great chance this weekend.
Yeah, I agree with you, Alan.
I'm going to go Martin Kaymer because I mentioned him earlier on, but just listening to Harrington there, I'd love to see him have a good week. And Tommy Fleetwood sounds like a great fella. I wouldn't mind going out for a round of golf with him. He sounds like a great character.
Indeed. Greg, listen, enjoy the whole week. I know it's one of your favourite times of the year as well. And having played the Pro-Am today, you're obviously up and ready and geared up to give us full coverage over the next couple of days. Thanks for joining us here on Game On. That's Greg Allen. And Alan is going to stay with us because after these, we're going to talk footy.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Healthy dinners made easy with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillets range. Available in selected stores nationwide. Game on football.
We ain't got no Euros today, but the big news is that Everton have appointed the former Liverpool boss Rafa Benitez as their new manager. Duncan Ferguson stays on as the assistant manager, and the former Ireland international Al Kelly will stay on as their goalkeeping coach.
I have been in Madrid, I have been in Naples defending Napoli, I have been in Valencia, so Tenerife, Extremadura, Liverpool, so every single club that I was there, I was fighting for them. So if you analyze things in the context, what you are expecting from your managers, you fight for your club. And I will do that. So since I'm here, I will fight for my club. I will try to win every single game. And it doesn't matter the opponents or the rivals. So it's something that you have to do. It's in your nature that you have to try to do your best. And why a lot of fans in a lot of these cities, they love me, is because I was giving everything for them. So then if you analyse this in the context, I think it's very clear that I will do the same. I'm happy with that.
Not very modest. Rafa Benitez there. We're going to talk to Alan Colley and also Mark Langdon of the Racing Post. But first, from Merseyside, Fergal Brennan, who is a journalist on Merseyside. What's the reaction over there, Fergal?
I think it's probably tipping a little bit more to pragmatism over the appointment. I think there's always going to be an element of objection to him taking over, obviously based on his connection with managing Liverpool and being very successful with them, and these comments that he has made in the past. Small club, criticised Everton and kind of hinted about them living in Liverpool's shadow, which obviously went down really badly at the time with the Everton fan base. And Everton fans, like most football fans, have long memories. They're well able to remember these things and how it irked them at the time and how it's lived with them. But I do think, as I say, it is generally tipping towards this idea that was over a decade ago that those comments were made. There's been a hell of a lot of water under the bridge since then, but for both clubs in terms of the directions that they've looked to take. And I think he himself, in that little clip there, he's faced this issue head on. He's not tried to hide behind it and water down what he said at the time. And I think I mentioned it on Thursday or Friday when I was on. He's essentially gone down that route as well of when you're in charge of a specific club, you say what you need to say, you do what you need to do at that time based on the objective that you're looking to achieve. That was his modus operandi when he was in charge of Liverpool. He will now change tack in terms of being in charge of Everton. And I think that's a little bit of the cold, hard reality of Premier League football. There's certain things that you might have to, you know, close your eyes and just not really listen to or think about in order to be successful, in order to be a force in the Premier League.
Yeah, Mark Langdon, Racing Post, joins us. Mark, he hasn't done a bad job over the last couple of years, especially with someone like Newcastle. Now, obviously with Liverpool, a team that went on to win Champions League under his tutelage. But what he did in Newcastle actually was pretty good, actually, in fairness to him.
Yeah, it was pretty good. I'm not sure it's quite as good as what sort of the Newcastle fans have been saying. It kind of one of them ones where it feels like it's got better, you know, with every month that Steve Bruce is in charge, and you know they kind of the Newcastle fans want to go back to Rafa Benitez. But I think what Rafa Benitez had with Newcastle, and he had it with Liverpool as well, maybe not so much. He was talking there about Madrid, and I'm not sure he went down particularly well there. But it was a connection with the supporters, and I think that's so important. important between manager and club. And Liverpool have got that with Jurgen Klopp. And you just feel like, you know, when everybody's connected, the team feels like it's heading in the right direction. And that's why I don't understand the appointment, because there's not going to be that connection between the Everton fans and Rafa Benitez. Some of them may well have, you know, have that pragmatic kind of approach to it now that he's there, so they may as well get behind the team. But it's going to take an awful lot of winning matches before I think they truly accept him and take him on board and, you know, maybe even sing his name. I mean, that's not going to happen for a while. And by then, you know, you might already have kind of lost the faith. If you don't start well, it wouldn't be a massive surprise, was it, if you know, they were looking for a new manager in a few months' time. I just think it's a bizarre appointment to upset a large sort of section of your fan base for somebody that is a good manager. I'm not sure he's good enough to sort of upset your fans in this manner.
Okay, if you want to get in contact with us, 51552, that's our text number. Let us know if you're an Everton fan. Is it a good appointment? 51552, Twitter, @GameOn2FM. That's @GameOn2FM. Alan, do you think this is a good appointment?
Yeah, I'd be along the lines more of Fergal than Mark, to be honest with you. I get Mark's point, absolutely, but football fans are fickle, and if you start winning a few matches, they'll soon get on board with you. He's obviously a very good manager, as we all know. And to be fair, the comments that he made about the club, I would agree with Fergal. It was over 10 years ago, and you do kind of, they were their biggest rivals. You do say things at the time when, obviously, against your rivals. He probably never envisaged for one second he'd be the manager of Everton back then. That was never on the radar. Time passes, and as I say, we're 10 years on, John, and now he's taken over Everton, and he's a very good manager, and as he said himself, he's very professional. He'll go in, do the job. He'll be trying every bit as hard with Everton as what he did when he was the manager of Liverpool. I don't think that will hinder him whatsoever. So I get what Mark's saying totally in terms of maybe alienating a few fans, but football fans are fickle. Once you start winning a few matches, they'll be on board. And he is a very good manager. You can't get away from that fact. I know he's been out of the Premier League maybe at the, I suppose, the top level. Newcastle, he was just trying to keep them above, I suppose, relegation. And I would agree with you, he did do a good job there. But I think he's better than Newcastle, and I think it's a move up for him as well. Everton are one of them clubs that will be hoping to maybe break into the top six or whatever the case may be. I can't see them breaking into the top four. But I do think he's at that level. He's obviously a very good manager. So, yeah, I don't mind it at all. I think it's a good appointment, John, and I look forward to seeing him coming back.
Yeah, Fergal, with obviously the lot of focus on England where you are in terms of the Euros and getting through to the quarterfinals as well, it's a good time to announce somebody like Benitez taking over at Everton, I would presume.
It is. I know Liverpool as a city, whether it's Liverpool or Everton fans, are not necessarily the biggest fans of the England national team, but there is kind of a little bit of a ripple effect given how they've progressed into the quarterfinals last night. But in terms of Benitez, just going back to what Mark and Alan were saying, I do take this idea that the fans will be important in all of this, and you look at the high regard that he's still held in by Newcastle fans. Steve Bruce has done a relatively steady job as far as a lot of Newcastle fans are concerned. He'll never be Rafa in their eyes, and he does have a battle on his hands to win over the Everton fan base. But I also think there's quite a big group of Everton fans that look at this and go, they bought hook, line and sinker the idea with Ancelotti that he was completely invested in the project. And
well, if you don't mind me saying so, Fergal, in terms of Newcastle fans and Everton fans, Newcastle fans, well, they tend to believe stuff that it doesn't actually happen. But from Everton fans, they're in past glories include Cup winners, League champions, FA Cup winners as well. Newcastle don't win anything. So their expectation level is probably too high, whereas Everton, I think, are taking a much more pragmatic approach.
It isn't. I mean, Everton haven't won a major trophy since 1995.
True.
Like, there's a generation of fans that have kind of survived on a diet of two FA Cup finals. So I think, again, generationally, that's interesting. That's probably where a lot of this comes down to. A lot of the younger Everton fans that I've spoken to are relatively okay with it. A lot of the older fans are not, because of the fact that, as far as they're concerned, taking an ex-Liverpool manager, based on the fact that when they were young, they were huge rivals of each other. This is a kind of a no-go area. So he does, as Mark said, he does have a big job on his hands in terms of fan base. But I think, yeah, if he does start well, if he does win a few games, if he does have them in the top half of the table come the business end of next season, it will be a step forward. But I think there's a big feeling of a bit of a sting, a bit of hurt after Ancelotti left, because he's essentially stood up and walked away when a lot of Everton fans put a lot of stock in the fact that he was this incredible manager and was going to move the club forward. What Benitez is maybe a bit more of a realistic step of where Everton are as a football club.
Yeah, I think you're right there. In terms of the stadium itself, I know there's a lot of talk about new stadia there at Goodison Park. Any update on that, Fergal?
Yeah, I mean, it's all set to continue. The spade should be in the ground somewhere at the start of next year. There's been some local objections. Liverpool could potentially lose their UNESCO World Heritage status over it. So it kind of seems to be a little bit of a game of chicken between the two parties of who will get their wish. But as it stands, it's been given the go-ahead by the local council. As I say, work should start on it at the start of 2022. But probably looking towards the 2023-24 season optimistically before there'll be any football played in it. And Goodison Park, it'll be a sad farewell when eventually the lights go out on the last night there, because it's been a real home for them for so long and such a long-standing ground in English top-flight football. But again, moving along with this idea that Everton fans realise they have to move on, they cannot stay within the framework that they are now, and that includes on the pitch, the manager, and obviously the stadium.
All right, thanks for joining us. That's Fergal Brennan there on Merseyside. We're going to hang on to Mark Langdon and Alan Colley. As an Everton fan, I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do. Can't do any worse than some of the managers we had. That's Matt in Dublin, who is an Everton fan, as I mentioned. Mark Langdon, Barcelona yet to reach a deal with Lionel Messi. He becomes a free agent tomorrow on the 1st of July. Any update on that?
No, Barcelona are confident that that Lionel Messi will stay with the club. Obviously, would be the most expensive free transfer in the history of football if he did decide to move to, I don't know, a Manchester City or a Paris Saint-Germain, because although he's out of contract, the wages and signing on fee that he would command would be astronomical. So I think Barcelona are confident that they can raise the money, even though they've had many issues in sort of the financial department over the last 12 months or so, that they can sort of, you know, get Messi to sign another contract, to also to show him that their ambitions are to sort of get back up among the sort of, you know, the best teams in the Champions League, because Barcelona have dipped below that in recent times. I think that you know, behind the scenes they are putting building blocks in place to become stronger again. Memphis Depay, I think, will be a good signing from Lyon. I also think that the emergence of, say, Pedri in midfield, who's had a really big impact on the European Championship so far, Messi struck up a wonderful relationship with him over the sort of final sort of 6 months or so of the La Liga campaign. So it feels like they're in a different place to what they were this time last year, when it seemed certain that Messi would depart and he eventually stayed on. Of course, this time around, Barcelona are confident that they won't have to force him to stay, that he actually wants to stay.
Yeah. Alan, Spurs looks like they're going to close in on Nuno Espirito Santo, the former Wolves manager, as their next one. I think that's a good appointment if they get him.
I like him, yeah. I like him, John. I think it'd be a good appointment for Spurs. This has been dragging out with Spurs at the moment, and obviously who's going to take over, who's not. I know when there was the
Pochettino possibly,
yeah, and even, yeah. I suppose after that as well, there was a couple of names mentioned, and fans then were getting on board and they weren't happy and all that kind of stuff. So I think they do need to make an appointment fairly quick. Obviously, you're looking at Harry Kane as well in terms of, will he move on? So when he sees a manager coming in the door, will it be more so in line with trying to keep him, which is obviously, but I think that deal is done. I think Kane is gone anyway, John, no matter who comes in, what manager comes in. But I think in terms of Spurs themselves bringing in Nuno, I think he did a great job at Wolves. Last year, I wouldn't judge him too harshly with the season that they had, because obviously they lost a couple of their best players as well. And to be fair, I just felt, looking at him with Wolves, that he kind of taken them as far as he could. The first two or three years at Wolves, they were brilliant. I felt himself looking at him, and his body language just felt, I've done my job here now.
Yeah,
I'm
he
ready
for the championship, got him to a Europa League.
Yeah, and he did
final.
A good job. Yeah, I think it's a good appointment. I always felt he was going to go higher than Wolves. Yeah. He always struck me as that type of manager that had lots of ability and potential to go further and higher. And for him, it's certainly a step up from Wolves, and it will be a good appointment.
Good for Matt Doherty as well, I suppose, Mark Langdon, if you got Espirito Santo in there.
Yeah, I would have thought so. It wasn't a very good first season. Of course, that the fact that Jose Mourinho didn't often play with a back three, I think, really impacted on Doherty's sort of ability to get forward on that right-hand side, because obviously he likes to play as a wing-back, and I'm not sure that he's strong enough defensively necessarily to play out that role in a back four, sort of week in, week out. The wing-back role suits him perfectly. Paratici, the new sporting director, according to reports, one of the things that he wants in a coach is for them to play a back three, which may be one of the reasons why Nuno is eventually about to get the job, because they feel like the players that they've got there sort of better suited to playing that formation, and the recruitment will be based around playing some kind of 3-5-2 or 3-4-3, however, you know, maybe even a 3-4-1-2, depending on who that they get to fill in the other positions there. But certainly it feels like Tottenham are moving to wing backs, and I think it does suit the players that they've got there. Even on the left hand side, Reguilón, I think, is a better left wing back than he is a left full back. And also, I mean, a bit of a forgotten man really, but Ryan Sessegnon, Tottenham paid a lot of money for him from Fulham. He was on loan in the Bundesliga the season we've just had. He's somebody, again, I think, that would be suited to a left wing back role rather than a left back role.
Johnny Casey's a Spurs fan. If we don't get somebody quick, we could end up with Saul Campbell, I think he's obviously referring to. Let's move it on quickly for the last couple of minutes of this football discussion, then, to talk about the Euros final quarterfinals this weekend. Spain and Switzerland. I'm on commentary on that. Looking forward to it with Kenny Cunningham. Belgium, Italy, 8 o'clock Friday. On Saturday, it's Denmark against the Czech Republic, and England against Ukraine. Alan, you think England have a great chance?
I've said it from day one. I thought they had a great chance, John, and I think it's been borne out so far. I think the manager is absolutely excellent in terms of how he handles things. The English job over the years is notoriously difficult in terms of it can be a poison chalice, and it can destroy managers, as we've seen over the years, particularly with the media scrutiny that's on them. The way he conducts himself and carries himself and handles himself with the media and gets them all on board and on side, I think it's been absolutely fantastic, John. And if you go back to the fact that they got to the semi-final in the World Cup, but he didn't come back patting himself on the back. He came back and went through a period of self-reflection and detailed analysis and how they could improve and how they wanted him to improve, to go that one step further, and that's what he's been doing. And he's been building towards this over that last 2 years, as I say. Obviously, there's all the talent that comes along as well, and everybody, there's a big clamour for Jack Grealish and Foden and Mount and all these brilliant players. But I think he's been true to himself in believing in what he wants to do. And I think a weaker manager, and particularly if you're weak mentally, you'd buckle under that pressure, John, with the whole country clamouring for a Jack Grealish. And I love Jack Grealish, but I think, and don't get me wrong, if they didn't get the result yesterday, straight away everybody would have went to Southgate and says, you were too safe, you were too conservative, you should have played the attacking players. But it's gone for him, and it's gone for him in all the results so far. They haven't conceded a goal. Pickford's been excellent. He has a brilliant relationship with Pickford. When everybody was criticising Pickford at Everton, he stayed loyal to him, Southgate, because he never let him down. Trippier, when they were complaining about Trippier when he played him the left side in the first match against Croatia, he has a brilliant relationship with him. He played very well again yesterday. So he has these players that he has a brilliant bond and relationship with that he's built up. Harry Kane, he's been loyal to him. The nonsense over whether they should have dropped Harry Kane and not played him was absolutely ridiculous, John. Harry Kane is a superstar, and we saw yesterday him getting the goal, and he's going to kick on from that as well. But I think it's more about the relationships and what Southgate has built over a period of time now, that this is their time. I think they're ready to win. Fair enough, the draw has opened up for them. It wasn't like it's a vintage Germany team. Germany have been in decline over the last 18 months.
Yeah.
Fair enough, but they still had to get the job done under a lot of pressure, and I think he deserves an enormous amount of credit for the way he handles himself, as I say, the way he conducts himself, and the way he's stayed true to himself in the way, as I say, the players that he's picked, the formation, everything that he's done so far has worked out perfectly for him.
Yeah, Mark, what's your feelings? Do you think England can do it?
I think they'll get to the final. I still think that Italy and even Spain, people are still not really talking about Spain that much. But
goals in two games.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually feel like they, you know, apart from that mad 10 minutes against Croatia where they conceded a couple of goals, I mean, I think they've looked really a balanced team, actually. And if they start taking, they've created even more chances. You know, they've scored 10 in the last two. I would go for maybe Spain, actually, at this stage in the final. But I do think England will get to the final now. The draw has opened up. And it would, you know, I mean, if they don't beat Ukraine, then Southgate will be getting all kinds of pelters, no matter what's gone before. They should beat Ukraine. Semi-final, if they get that far, could be trickier. I think Denmark have done better than, you know, than people have expected. But I still think the final might be a step too far.
In previous years as well, John, if you look at the way the group, the way their draw has opened up for them now, what would beat England in previous years is themselves, because the hype has obviously gone through the roof. But again, this is where the manager is absolutely brilliant and so humble. The first thing he did yesterday was say, we've won nothing, we've achieved nothing. And not only him, you look at the players that he has with Harry Kane, Jordan Henderson, Maguire, all captains at their club, big strong characters. They're telling all the young fellas back at the camp today, lads, cool the jets, we've done nothing yet, we've achieved nothing, we had a good win yesterday, but they've been brought straight back down to earth, and all their focus is on is the next match. And there's a lot of humility about that group, John. And as I say, and this nonsense, I remember Roy Keane saying before the start of the group, and it was a brilliant soundbite, and I love Roy Keane, right, but the nonsense that he came out with, oh well, Jordan Henderson must be great at playing card tricks, is that why they're bringing him? Jordan Henderson came on yesterday, he's jumping up and down just before he comes on. The bond that he has with Southgate, he's acting as a captain and a leader in amongst that group today. That's why he's in the squad, that's why he's there, because all these players, as I say, the leaders that he has in that group, John, is going to benefit Southgate, make it easier for him to manage as well, because the players are managing the dressing room, and make it so much easier to go on and win a tournament.
Yeah, I think he might be in the right place and the right time, isn't he, Gareth Southgate? Finally, Mark Langdon, he seems to be the man for the occasion. I saw him commiserate with the Germans first off, and then he went straight to the substitutes after the game against Germany to basically say, look, we're all in this together.
Yeah, I think it's really important. I think virtually every international team that's had success, you know, that squad bond, because it is a long time that you're together, and if the subs don't feel like they're part of the action, you know, you can just get that little split in the camp, and you never know when you might need you know, a reserve left back or something like that, because you know you can't be sure where the injuries are coming from. I felt he used his bench very well against Germany. It's been something I've been very critical of Southgate previously. I don't think he always makes the best use of his substitutes, but he changed the game when he brought Grealish on, opened it up, and they deserve to win probably just about in the end.
All right, thanks for joining us. Mark Langdon there from the Racing Post. Spain against Switzerland, 5 o'clock Friday, 8 o'clock Belgium, Italy. What a mouth-watering game that is. That's 8 o'clock Friday. 5 o'clock Saturday, Denmark against the Czech Republic, and the 8 o'clock on Saturday is England against Ukraine. We're talking to Denise Masterson on the Dubs Ladies National Football League win after this break.
Game on 2FM with Green Fern. Naturally good food packed with protein. Game on.
Gaelic football.
In the last couple of minutes, we're going to talk about the Dubs women's team, that is, who won the National League title, their second National Football League Division 1 title. Impressive win over Cork the weekend. Former Irish rugby international Hannah Tyrrell contributing 7 points. Captain Sinead Ahern added another 5 as the Sky Blues won in that game, and another National League title under their belt under the guidance of Mick Bowen. And Denise Masterson joins me on the line. Hi, Denise.
Hi, John, how are you?
Very good. Impressed by the Dubs?
Very, very, to be honest, yeah. I thought it was a very accomplished performance by them. Moving the ball really fast, and they still probably don't have their full-strength squad out, so that's very exciting now, I say, for them looking ahead to the Championship.
Yeah. What did you make to Cork?
I think no more than the All-Ireland final last year. I think Cork started really, really strong. They seemed to come out with the traps reared up to go, and they come out against Dublin. But I think Dublin just moved the ball too fast. They were probably more tenacious in their back line. You know, they've some really mean defenders back there, working together really well. I thought Niamh Collins and Leah, they had really good games in the full back line, half back line for Dublin. And Cork probably coughed up a lot of cheap possession. And then they had an awful lot of wides that they were really rue. But like I said, Dublin just moving the ball so fast, really nice short passes, long passes, working it through the middle of the park. They were just, I thought it was a very impressive display by Dublin.
You're a former All-Ireland winning captain as well, and you've worked under or been under the auspices of what's going on in Dublin football ladies wise over the last couple of seasons as well. What's gone right for Dublin under Mick Bohan?
Well, obviously the structures that he's put in place, but I think there's such a lovely blend with the ended up in team. I mean, the player of the match on Saturday in the league final was Siobhan McGrath. Like, she is really one of the stalwarts. I mean, Lindsay Davies, for me, like, she's one of the best players in the country, if not the best player in the country. And they've, like, 15 years experience playing for Dublin. And then you feel like Caoimhe O'Connor in the forward line has been a relatively younger player, you know, or Hannah Leahy there in the back line. And they're coming in, and I suppose they're seeing the standards that have set. No more than what Cork did, I suppose, when we were coming up against them back in All-Ireland in 2009. It's that lovely mix, I suppose, of experience and youth and the energy. And then, like you said, Hannah Tyrrell coming back into the fold as well. You know, I actually bumped into her the week before the game, and, you know, she's full of energy and enthusiasm for her and thinks there's a real buzz around the camp. So, you know, I suppose when teams are winning as well, it breeds a really positive mentality and everybody's hungry to get on the pitch, you know. So, I suppose there's two things going on. I think Mick and Harris is a really good team, and obviously then what he's done to blend the younger players in with that as well, and the structures that are in place, and the fact that they all just seem to love playing under him as well, you know. So, like I said, it's worrying for the rest of the championship, maybe for other teams.
I was going to ask you that. Is there anything to touch the Dubs in the championship, do you think?
I mean, Cork started really strong against them. Cork, like I said, they had an awful lot of boys and coughed up cheap possessions, so I'm sure they're going to do a lot of work on that. Now, I'm saying that, you know, Dublin still have goalies to come back in. Carla Rowe came on in the second half. You know, she'd had a calf injury, and they're two big players for Dublin who probably inject even more pace into the team, you know, which is Brian and I suppose prospect considering how fast Dublin were moving the ball there on Saturday evening against Cork. But I mean, they would be definitely hot favourites for the championship, but like I said, I'm sure Cork will be hungry to go at them again. You just wonder in these tight games, and the 1 point to see earlier in the league, you know, I think psychologically, you know, that starts playing on teams when it comes to big days again coming up against Dublin. Whereas on the flip side of that, I think Dublin are in a place now where they no matter how a game starts, they just keep chipping away, you know, at the process, and the results seem to fall for them.
All right, thanks for joining us. That's Denise Masterson there. We look forward to the championship. The men's championship is already underway. We look forward to the ladies' championship starting pretty soon. We'll take a quick break.
Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillets. Available in selected stores nationwide.
That's it. Hope you've enjoyed the programme. Damien O'Mara is here tomorrow. Tara Stewart's next. I'm John Kenny. Bye.